This episode of The Bladder Presents is brought to you in part by Kingkiller Studios. Conveniently located on the shores of the fragrant Gowanus, Kingkiller Studios has offered premium music rehearsal space, creative community, and audio and video editing services for over a decade. For more information or to schedule a visit or location scout, visit kks.nyc. That's kks.nyc. And for $50 off your first month's rent, use the code BLOTTER50 at signing. That's BLOTTER50. Kingkiller Studios, rooms to mix it up. And now, on with the episode.
An acre's a dewy, wet, fat, ripe tomatoes.
Tomatoes?
Tomatoes. Police work so noisy. Tomatoes are so
quiet.
Quiet. Yeah.
Yeah.
On the Mount Rushmore of foundational true crime writing, there remained one face I had never studied. Joseph Wambaugh, ex-Marine and cop and author of The Onion Field. I'm joined today by Kevin Smokler to talk about the murder of Ian Campbell, the influences on and of Wambaugh's writing, how the system failed perpetrators and victims, and the Hey, It's That Guy annual picnic as we discuss The Onion Field, both book and film, in The Bladder Presents, episode 86. Welcome back to The Bladder Presents, a podcast examining the idea that while crime is bad, some of the stories about crime can be pretty good. I'm joined once again by my great good friend, Kevin Smokler. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Sarah. Thanks so much for having me back.
Thanks so much for coming back and for helping me to tackle a couple of properties that I really feel I should have engaged with years, if not decades ago. Given what I do on this podcast and my interests in reading and film. So our cold case is twofold today. We are discussing The Onion Field, first the book and then the movie, although if there's some crossover between the two areas of discussion, so be it. The Onion Field, originally published in 1973 by Joseph Wambaugh. And for the case file, I am actually going to take a couple of pages from Popular Crime by Mr. Bill James. He does an excellent job of summarizing the case, so why reinvent the wheel? Here we go. About 10 o'clock on the evening of March 9th, 1963, a Saturday night, officers Ian Campbell and Carl Hettinger stopped two men in a car. They were patrolling Hollywood, and they stopped the two men because they looked like hoodlums, using a missing rear license light as a specific legal excuse to make the stop. One of the hoodlums, Gregory Powell, pulled a gun on Campbell, took Campbell's weapon, and forced Hettinger to surrender his. They drove them on a county road in the San Joaquin Valley between two onion fields, where Powell murdered Officer Campbell. Hettinger broke and ran. His glasses fell off. He ran blindly through the onion fields, pursued by the two armed men who had just murdered his partner. Powell was arrested leaving the area in a stolen car. His partner, Jimmy Smith, was apprehended in Bakersfield the next day. They confessed to the crime, were convicted, and were sentenced to die in the California gas chamber. Hettinger, meanwhile, had escaped into a personal hell. Police Inspector John Powers, described as the General Patton of the Los Angeles Police Department, drafted an order known as the Hettinger Memorandum, which second-guessed Hettinger's decision to surrender his weapon and ordered all members of the force never, ever to do anything like that again. Hettinger, who felt tremendous guilt over the death of his partner, was pushed further into depression and despair. He began to steal things, shoplifting, and was forced to leave the police force. So this section of Bill James's book goes on to talk about the way that crime was portrayed and the sort of overlap between evolving ideas of crime and true crime and evolving ideas of protecting prisoners and accused's rights after Escobedo, after the Miranda decision, and so on. Mm-hmm. We'll get back to that later, but let's not get too sidetracked by Popular Crime, which is a book that I've read and reread many times and think is great, and talk about Wambaugh, which is a book that I don't know if I'm going to reread it, but I thought it was great too. I was feeling like it couldn't possibly live up to the great things that other true crime authors had said about it, but I was relieved to find that it is quite well done. Kevin, what was your experience of reading the book? Did you enjoy it? 4 stars out of 5? Where did you fall on that?
Well, first I should say, I had heard of The Onion Field, I believe, through Roger Ebert's review of the movie way back in the day. And I was intrigued because it was murder. It was the Los Angeles Police Department, a subject I've been interested in for a long time. But it all came home to roost in The Onion Field after reading Popular Crime at your recommendation. So that's the complete circle of how we got here in the first place.
You're being very kind. I actually like literally forced the book on him, listeners. I was like, I think you'd really like this. Just in case, here. Read it.
Exactly. I picked up a mass market paperback edition of The Onion Field with an introduction by James Ellroy.
Same one and, I have.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And after reading the introduction, you are kind of reminded in both a sad yet useful way that Joseph Wambaugh, how do you pronounce his last name?
I'm going to go with Wambaugh.
I'll go with that too.
He's still living, and if he's within the sound of our voices, and that's not correct, I welcome corrections. Once again, it's the very English scandal thing all over again. I think I was calling this The Onion Fields. It's actually The Onion Field. I don't know what my problem is lately. Anyway, sorry to interrupt you. Continue.
Oh, no, that's all right. When you read James Ellroy's introduction, James Ellroy is incredibly self-conscious of himself as a writer. And there's a lot of show-offy, performative stuff in his introduction. And if James Ellroy wasn't so good at it and hadn't worked so hard to be good at it, you'd find it obnoxious. But instead there's something kind of crudely charming about it. I also, if you put this book next to In Cold Blood, which is a book written about a murder but by a writer – The Onion Field, and this is perhaps an unfair comparison, but The Onion Field feels a little bit like a cop who has become a writer. It is thorough to the point, almost to the point of exhaustion. There is no detail left out, and his reporting is second to none. There are times in this 491-page book where I feel like when he cites the Onion Field murder as at the time the longest court case in California history. Well, this feels like the longest book about the longest court case in California history. There are times where he doesn't quite know when to quit, and there are times when the book feels more like the gathering and presenting of evidence than it does the telling of a story. But I think overall, I don't know if I'd read it again, but I really applauded the effort. And the idea of Joseph Wambaugh, who at the time was already a published author, was The Onion Field is his third book, and he was two novels about LAPD officers into his career at this point, the first one of which, The New Centurions, is the one that made him famous. So I was convinced The Onion Field was the book that broke him wide, but it was not.
I didn't know that he was a novelist, and I didn't know that he had been a cop before. I don't think I knew anything about him except what I had read from other people and recommendations from other true crime aficionados. So,
yeah, and now he's kind of a true crime household name. Writing both fiction and nonfiction, all from his experience of being on the LAPD, you know, at this point, 40 years before his, you know, 40 years in the past of his now, you know, dozen and a half so book literary career. It's a fascinating case, and I guess I'm wishing for something that is impossible. I'm wishing for Joseph Wambaugh to be less of a cop and more of a historian, less of a cop and more of a writer. I wish this book had been more open and specific about the significance of this case, because the way he presents it is that the significance of this case is largely that it dragged on so long, and that was mostly an accident of history, that this case happened at the same time as the Miranda verdict comes down, creating the Miranda law and effectively throwing out the first trial of the Onion Field killers. And then later on, at California's abolishing of the death penalty in the early 1970s, which meant that these guys who were sentenced to death didn't end up with that fate. I guess my summary is I wish it was less cop and more of what I like, but that's a totally selfish and self-centered way to view this.
Well, I think that it has, unfortunately, it suffers from the timing, because I feel like it was still, you know, sort of in the act of being created while events were unfolding around it. Mm-hmm. So this is one case where, like the movie, I think you have a little bit better distance, and he also wrote the screenplay for the movie, and I think was able to telescope things down better. Like, I mean, when he's writing the courtroom parts, it's not that it was boring. It was skimmable, and I did skim some of it because
me too.
Irving Kenarek, I'm not sure how you pronounce that. He was, I don't even remember whose attorney he, I think he actually was representing Jimmy Smith.
Yes, and, I believe so.
Was like removed, put back on, removed. And he's one of those like Fisher Stevens on Law and Order lawyers who just like files endless motions, takes forever to do it, takes forever to object, very florid language. Drives everyone crazy. And Bill James has a passing comment in the same section about how prosecutors like Bugliosi, if given the choice of executing Manson or Kenarek, would have chosen to execute Kenarek. Like, he drove everybody fucking bazoo. Yeah. But
someone who really saw the courtroom as his community theater stage.
Yeah. And also, I mean, this is a zealous defense of the client, but you also have a client who is exploiting certain aspects of the system. We'll get into that later, but I think Wambaugh did not have the luxury of knowing which parts of these proceedings, either the initial trial, the retrial, there was like a mistrial declared in one of the penalty phases. I think in the early 70s, he didn't have the luxury of knowing which of these would be deemed important to history. So all of that had to be left in. The film sort of skims over it in a couple of scenes. We'll get into other things that the film kind of telescopes down for good or ill to get everything into 2 hours and 6 minutes. But here's what I found interesting about this book, which for whatever reason, I think it is important in the genre because it does come so early and it is, relatively speaking, well done. Is it as good as In Cold Blood? No. But it, first of all, does not have In Cold Blood's perhaps problematic relationship with the killers on the part of author. Although I'm pretty sure Wambaugh puts himself into this narrative as a Mario Sue objecting to the Hettinger memorandum. Did you feel certain that that was him?
I didn't feel certain, but I did find that moment really jarring, and I did find that was sort of for something that is for a book that is 491 pages and still feels I think as you put out, as you say, quite justifiably, like it's scrambling to keep up with the narrative because it is unfolding as the book is being written. Mm-hmm. That feels like he just turned, you know, he just turned to face the camera like a 1950s pitchman and was like some thoughts on what we've just seen.
A social hygiene film also that it's like, yeah, what have we learned about this, the Hettinger memorandum? But I did feel that, especially given how early in like the life cycle of this genre, which at this time consisted of, Capote,
mm-hmm.
that Poe story about right. Marie Roget, I think it's called, and yeah. Like those cheap magazines that Anne Rule used to write for before she wrote The Stranger Beside Me, where the ink would come off on your hands, that were like ladies' magazines that, you know, and just really like pulpy stuff. So he was kind of the only game in town. But it's still quite impressive to me. Like, I know what happened. I've read about this case before. And what happened doesn't happen until 42% of the way through the book.
Yeah.
And it's not a short book as we've noted. So I was impressed. I expected to be quite impatient with, like, here's everyone's life story up to this point. And at times, particularly the lingering over Ian Campbell's bagpiping.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I believe my margin note was, and God help me, but I believe it was, and I quote, "No wonder someone killed him." I'm so sorry, Campbell family. He seemed like a very nice man. But holy shit, I love that his mom like sends him outside to annoy the entire La Brea neighborhood instead of just their immediate neighbors. Like, lady, you sold a piano for the why? So that was a little much, but I felt generally in the first half of the book leading up to the, you know, actual murder, that was quite well done, perhaps borrowing from Capote, but there's worse rips to take.
Absolutely. I don't remember if this, so the Onion Field book comes out in 73. Had Fatal Vision come out before this?
No, Fatal Vision, that crime occurred in 1970. And I believe the writing began in McDonald's federal trial, which was 1979.
Okay.
Late 70s. So, yeah.
Okay, got it. So the crime happens before this book is written, but the book about it doesn't happen until much
correct.
Later. Yes, but I felt the same way about the bagpiping thing, by the way. I'm the kind of person who likes to look at the Google Street Map of where things happened. So I zoomed in on the intersection of Carlos and Gower in Hollywood via the 3D Google map to see the little sign there that says it that area is now called Ian Campbell Square. That's where the abduction happened.
Interesting.
Would it surprise me that if there was a similar sign in Hancock Park that said, "Here's where Ian Campbell ceased playing bagpipes to the joy of all of his neighbors"?
Oh,
no,
dear.
It would not surprise me at all. But
God.
I always like looking things like that up because I find, particularly in Los Angeles, which I find is a place that is often considered geographic less, but is nonetheless completely drunk with the significance and portents of every street corner. Los Angeles as a city has more names for more neighborhoods and more signs that something significant or some television show from 1961 was filmed here than probably any city in the United States. But in this case, I felt like it was warranted. And I think you make a really good point. Like, this is it. Maybe this comes very early in the history of true crime books. And it comes most uniquely in that it was written by a former police officer of the very department that employed the victim of this murder. That's too good a story for our author to pass up. And B, that contextualizes it in a way that I feel like allows Joseph Wamba to do certain things and not others. And the fact that he stuck with it for as long as he did means that, yeah, at sometimes it feels like he's just the stenographer trying furiously to keep up with the story as it goes by. And it is not unartful while he's doing that. The skimming, I did the skimming in the same place you did. I felt like since I knew the murder had taken place and since I unceremoniously skipped to the end to find out who was still alive and who wasn't, I didn't need to read how we got there. And once the setting moved to the courtroom.
Yeah. It is, I think, better than it. I mean, it's like better than it has a right to be, I guess, because I just had to look this up because I actually wasn't sure about these timelines. But like the late 70s is where you have this like detonation that causes the rock face of the Mount Rushmore of true crime to crumble, revealing Norman Mailer, Anne Rule, McGinnis. Yeah. Helter Skelter was the year after this. And while that is a seminal book, Bugliosi as a writer was a hell of a prosecutor. So,
and at the time it was seen more as a capturing of current events and celebrity gossip than it was a true crime book. Right.
Yeah. And he was the prosecutor. So he did have an inside track on that. And I'm sure, that's another angle on the impossibility of dealing with Irving Kinnaric. But this is, you know, because it came first, it doesn't necessarily have to be all that good. But I think that in comparison to the sort of 1979, 1980 texts that I just mentioned, I think it shows well. Look, I'm not going to sit here and defend Norman Mailer as a quote human being to anyone.
Nor should any of us. No,
I mean, I'm not putting myself in that position. Thanks anyway. But I think the Executioner song is underrated and has been perhaps purposefully forgotten or like kicked under the bed to a degree that I think is not okay. He won a Pulitzer and he deserved it. It is an amazing document. Most particularly for the way that it can move amongst points of view and subtly vary the diction depending on who he's talking about. And Wambaugh is not Mailer, but he shows pretty well on that. He does that pretty well. There are, you know, this is a crime that occurred in 1963. This book was published in 1973. This is, I must warn everyone, this is just not how we talk about LGBTQIA plus people. This is not how we talk about African-American people. I think that he is reporting on how other people talk more than he is using unfortunate argo, but it's still like there's one page in particular where just about every horrible quote synonym for gay man is reeled off, and it's like, who is that for?
Yeah, this book, I understand it was capturing a state of affairs at this time within Los Angeles and within the LAPD, but it does that too selectively, if you ask me. It spends an awful lot of time on this incident when Ian Campbell was still alive of a gay man, you know, caught in the middle of a gay sex act in Griffith Park being hauled into the police station. And it essentially makes homosexuality, which I believe it was at that time, a criminal classification, the same way you would classify robbery or kidnapping as one.
Oh, sure.
And it has very little of consequence to do with the rest of the story, other than the sheer coincidence that Carl Powell would use that as a defense later on in one of his many appeals. But it is a zoom in on the inner workings of the LAPD that is largely unnecessary, at the expense of 100 other areas where they could have talked about the LAPD and its relationship with the city.
Well, and I think that was probably, as we've seen in the intervening or the ensuing decades, if you go down that side street, you're not coming back. Basically, like entire books have been written about this, and we will actually have a couple of recommendations for those in the show notes. And I understand that Wambaugh either didn't want to jeopardize his access or perhaps just felt that was opening like a 15-part Robert Caro length can of worms. But I also felt that given that Powell was gay, but was also like, I'm not sure that sociopaths can be said to experience sexuality in the way that we do, that attraction for them is completely about power and control and getting over and taking advantage.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's sort of difficult to say what his sexuality was when, you know, those aren't like, those synapses are not the same.
Yeah.
For you and me.
Yeah.
But I did think that given when it was written, that when he's talking about Powell's adolescence and this experience that he has with the, when he runs away from home and this experience with the priest and later the sort of strange alpha beta, not exactly sexual relationship that he and Jimmy Smith appear to have when they're in the penitentiary together.
Yeah.
That I think that he is relatively deft and not making a big point of, you know, that you might expect, not making the point you might expect that this is criminal behavior, pathological behavior. He just sort of says what he sees happening or what he's been told was happening and then leaves it there. So that, like, when he's sort of describing Powell's development into an adult, mm-hmm. he's sort of circumspect about that stuff. But then there's, you know, long passages where he's underlining, I think, a little too firmly the ingrained homophobia of the time. That's like, we got it.
Yeah, looking at the sitting in the very privileged lazy boy recliner of 40 years of hindsight, like,
exactly.
It's easy. Yeah, we say that this is that there's too much emphasis. There's too much emphasis on this, given the enormity of the story and all of the different cultural and sociological and even political issues it takes in. It seems less consequential than Mr. Wambaugh wants to make it. I know I'm circling back to something we said a little bit earlier, you know, but it seems to me that this story, that this book is running to keep up with the story. Mm. And I would be curious to know, like, at what point they had to say, they have, you know, his publishers had to tell him to stop and actually get the manuscript out there.
Right. Yeah. So would I.
Yeah, it's undoubtedly so that was happening as the tale was still unfolding.
Well, I'm wondering if you saw in the prose any influences reflected forward in things that you've read in the interim. I was not surprised that there would be an introduction by James Ellroy that talked about how he had been like trying to finish The Onion Field through like 4 or 5 years of bouncing in and out of rehabs and shelters and stuff.
Yes.
And there is definitely this like mid-century bebop diction that mm-hmm. Wambaugh has that Ellroy sort of like taffy pulls to the absolute end of its usefulness. And I just read Ellroy's memoir like a few months ago. So this is sort of fresh in my mind that can be a little bit tough to tolerate, that like, just sort of like you're not hearing jazz, but you're almost hearing jazz. I think that it's, you know, you get used to it, but it's definitely an acquired taste. And you can definitely see that influence on Wambaugh. You can see also the way that it's structured and how much time you spend with both victims and perpetrators prior to the central event. You see that in pretty much every book about crime, whether it's written from a more elevated historical angle or a pulpy black cover with shiny red writing angle, that this is the very traditional structure of how these stories are told. You see it on TV shows like 48 Hours. So I was wondering if there were any other exemplars that you saw in terms of the influence of this fairly early, like, pillar of the genre.
Yeah, the first one that came to mind is actually the sort of prologue in italics that carries that in most true crime books is simply the prologue that you then forget about as you've read the book. And then when you pick it up, if you decide to read it, read it a second time, months or years later, you're like, oh yeah, this is how the book starts. This prologue.
It's the author trying to be literary and you're like, oh, for fuck's sake. This worked better than most, but that's saying almost nothing.
Yeah, the sort of non-specific, whom are we hearing narrate this story, italicized prologue,
I feel like it maybe took me a little longer than it should have to figure out who the gardener was.
Oh yeah, I am so terrible at that stuff. Like, I was actually surprised when I was done reading, I had figured it out by then.
Whatever. This book is older than we are, so... there's like interstitials from the gardener who talks a lot about the plants that are involved and how he's getting a migraine and now his guts are churning and he just can't stop thinking about all the stuff he shoplifted. And if you know anything about the case, you should know probably after like one and a half of these that it's Carl Hettinger's inner monologue. It took me like four of them to figure it out.
Right. Yeah. I think it took me at least twice that many.
Oh, God. But, all right. Well,
like you said, yeah, I don't, this is me making a real wild ass guess, but I feel like it is a device taken from, pulp mystery novels. You know, it reminds me of Walter Neff's narration in Double Indemnity. You do know that it is the protagonist who is speaking, but you don't really know under what conditions he's giving. Why would he be telling his boss about, like, why would he be confessing to participating in a crime to his boss? And then at the end, it all makes sense as to how Walter Neff ends up telling this story to Edward G. Robinson's character.
I think that's actually dead on, because what more influential place in terms of putting the subconscious idea in your head that everything is a noir than to have been to have been LAPD in the 40s and 50s.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure Wambaugh is that old, actually, but he may be.
Mm-hmm. And I think it reminded me that, like, the guy was not without his novelist's toolbox. Like, he is not a poorly read person. Like, that's pretty clear to me. And yes, he had written two novels before he had written The Onion Field. I have no idea how good they are, or if one of them, The New Centurions, the first one made him famous, but I don't know how good they are as novels themselves. But as sort of artlessly as it is deployed in this book, I guess I should say not always artfully, it does tell me that this guy is knows a little bit of something about crafting a story, and wasn't just sort of offering up some hybrid of transcription and show-offiness about being there.
yeah,
wasn't leaning
you do
too
see,
hard on the thoroughness of his reporting.
Yeah, you do see, I mean, I'm all for like thorough reporting that is just stated as plainly as possible, but you mm-hmm. often see, and this is often what makes me bail out on page like 14 of a true crime book, that it's like, well, now I'm going to do the capital W writing, and it's like, oh,
yeah. Yeah.
Bye.
That is the great thing about Bill James. Bill James was an incredibly skillful writer, and yet never insists on yelling that in your ear.
Yeah. Well, because he doesn't, I think of himself as a writer first and foremost. Mm. So he just says what he knows and tries to put it in an order. And then occasionally there's this very almost haiku like poetry to what he's yeah. writing, because he's not trying to, like, it's not, you know, purple and damp. Mm-hmm. I would like to actually get back to Bill James's comments on this case, if we may.
Sure.
Because Bill James, look, I think his crime writing is excellent, but he does have some, not crackpot ideas, but he has some, let's say, jurisprudentially conservative and possibly crackpotty
mm-hmm.
concepts that it's not that he's incorrect, but he's just sort of being a little bit dadly about them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
a little like unworldly, a little like, well, from my vantage point in this office surrounded by books that I never leave, here is my solution to the criminal justice system.
Well, and he will sort of disingenuously be like, oh, well, you know, what do I know? I'm not a lawyer. But it's like, all right, but you want us to side with you on whatever you're saying. Yeah. Anyway, he continues after the part I read earlier to talk about the fact that 2 days after Ian Campbell was buried, I believe, Miranda was arrested. And then these cases, I think Dorado and Escobedo are the other cases to mm-hmm. do with, you know, at like giving suspects an attorney, telling them when they're being taken into custody that they have the right to remain silent and the right to an attorney. And then Miranda, which as it's limbed both in both book and movie, The Onion Field, had much more to do on its face with police not being allowed to mislead subjects in an interrogation. It wasn't so much like, you know, it wasn't so much were they properly Mirandized and given the warning that you've seen a gazillion times on Law and Order. It was police are not allowed to lie to or purposely confuse a suspect. Like, I don't think that that's carried forward. Anyway.
No.
Bill James goes on that, you know, Smith and Pell ended up back in court because of Miranda. And then, you know, then there was the death penalty issue and like endless arguments about why couldn't anyone remember or state with any certainty who had shot into Ian and Campbell's body once it was on the ground and so on and so forth. And here is Bill James's comment about how we began to understand true crime, or how we began to understand crime via true crime books that were written at various points in the middle of the last century. So here he is on page 223 of the paperback. For anyone who wants to understand the explosion in crime rates in this country between 1964 and 1976, there can be no better explanation than to read The Onion Field. The Supreme Court decisions of the mid-60s, though carrying no inevitable harm, established in the minds of lower courts the idea that the primary object of the process was not to deliver justice, but to protect the rights of the accused. The lower courts for 10 years thereafter competed to see who could force the police to jump through the most hoops in the process of trying to convict a criminal. The California Supreme Court, the Rose Byrd Court, ruled that the police had violated the cop killers' rights by being friendly with them so as to earn their trust so they would confess. Such, quote, psychological devices, they ruled, were condemned by the U.S. Supreme Court in Miranda v. Arizona. The best book about crime in the late 50s, early 60s is certainly In Cold Blood. But the book which can help you to truly understand America's prevailing attitudes about crime in that era is Birdman of Alcatraz. And the book which can help you to understand the transition that followed, how we got from Burt Lancaster to Charles Manson in just 7 years, is The Onion Field. And then he goes on the next page, the sympathy generated by Burt Lancaster on behalf of Robert Stroud became a tool with which Gregory Powell could battle the world. So sorry, that was kind of long, but I am, you know, it's a pity that in the book, he's like building the road and driving, like he's driving on a road that's being built. So
yeah.
He doesn't have any perspective on what Bill James feels is an overcorrection by liberal courts in the mid to late 60s, that there was a big movement for prisoners' rights, some of which got curdled and wound up in, you know, cults and kidnapping situations. But that's well beyond the scope of this particular episode of the podcast. Mm-hmm. But I think he makes an interesting point that... and he comes back to this in the book many times, that it's like there's procedure and then there's justice. Were you sort of reading this with any eye to how outside events and decisions, be it about the death penalty or Miranda or what have you, were you kind of, was that a ticker sort of running under your reading of this book that we didn't necessarily have the correct perspective on, you know, via the book on what was happening? How did this tie in for you?
Yeah, there was a couple of moments. I should say more than a couple, and I do not blame the author for this because as we've said, like this is these were largely opinions only available with the benefit of history and historical examination. Mm. But there was a couple of moments where, like, remember in the O.J. Simpson Made in America documentary, they ask a guy, you know, what was going on in Los, you know, a white guy, like, what was going on in Los Angeles in the summer of 1965 from your point of view? And he's like, USC was winning the national championship and OJ was making it happen for all of us. And then it cuts immediately to pictures of the to historical photos of the Watts riots. I think you can't blame the author for this, and maybe Bill James is leaning too heavily on this, but I don't know if what is in the Onion Field is what Bill James says is in the Onion Field. But if you know something,
that's also possible.
Yeah. If you know something about, how policing was changing at this time, particularly in Los Angeles, which I'm sure Bill James does, I think it is easy to give the Onion Field maybe that medal that it didn't quite earn, and again, not Joseph Wambaugh's fault. Like, but I think it is. It's I read the Onion Field now in 2019, and I say, well, it is worth pointing out that, you know, a month after this murder happens, Tom Bradley, the future longest serving and first black mayor of Los Angeles, becomes the first black city councilman of Los Angeles. And I'm not positive of this, but I believe the first former LAPD officer to become a city councilman. We see a little bit of it in the fact that Carl Hettinger, after he is taken off, you know, patrol duty, becomes William F. I believe who is the chief's name? Is it William F. Parker?
Parker.
Parker becomes Parker's driver, which, you know, and the Onion Field points out that this was historically like a cushy job that meant you were going up in the world of the LAPD.
Mm, yeah.
And Hettinger was on duty in this job when Parker died. Which brought about a sea change in the Los Angeles Police Department, as big as when Parker had taken over the job, you know, I believe it was 15 to 20 years before that. Strangely enough, like, what I see in that is how much our definition of this thing called police corruption has changed, because Parker takes the job as a way of cleaning up and professionalizing the LAPD, which at the time before him in the 40s and 50s was essentially like a sort of grifting. It was an organization where you gave, you know, your brother-in-law, where you gave your brother-in-law and your itinerant cousin a job, a city job, as a way of like assuring their vote and shutting them up. Mm. It was very much a sort of teapot. It was very much a kind of Teddy Roosevelt era corrupt urban police department.
I'm glad that you brought up the OJ Made in America, because first of all, I'm always happy to talk about it because it's brilliant. But second of all, I think it proved for every sort of document of a crime in Los Angeles before and after that had anything even tangentially to do with race, which they all ended up having to do with race, but that you can't. I think that if I had to point to the sort of one flaw that means that I'm not going to go back to the Onion Field and I'm not going to sort of return to it and continue to be compelled by it the way I have been by other true crime books, I think that it is not possible. I mean, again, as we said before, trying to unpack like the history and, you know, up to that point of the character, the Los Angeles Police Department, is like another three books, several of which we're about to recommend. But I get why it wasn't attempted, but unfortunately, it just flattens the narrative out because this critical aspect of it is missing. So I'm glad you brought that up, because it does occur to me now that the way that OJ Made in America, like, the context was so deep and so far reaching that when a document fails to do that, it's like, well, okay, there's this whole missing section. But you had a book recommendation on this tip, I believe.
Yeah, I learned most of what I learned about the LAPD from Joe Dominick's two-part sort of biography of the institution, the first of which is called To Protect and Serve and takes you from the foundation of the LAPD pretty much up to the LA riots and then of 1992, and then of 1994. And then the second volume, which I believe is just called Blue, takes you from the LA riots of 1994 to William F. Bratton taking over the department in the aughts, and the reform efforts that came about between, I believe that book ends in 2015. But I feel like what you're describing is the book, The Onion Field, for as thorough and as sort of on its like inherently compelling as the story is, feels a little bit like it's written in a terrarium. Like it's, yeah. You know, and maybe that be because it's written by a former police officer about the killing of a police officer from his own department. But it does not, you know, the fact that one of the defendants is mixed race comes up a little bit, but I wouldn't have minded a mention of the fact that the LAPD, you know, was in the wake of the Watts riots when these trials were happening. And that William F. Parker in the twilight of his police career had been lauded and universally loved in the law enforcement community as someone who had reformed and professionalized the LAPD, but did that very distinctly for white Los Angeles at the expense of all of the rest of Los Angeles. Mm. A point that Tom Bradley made, you know, when he became an LA city councilman, that in fact, when he was elected to public office as an ex-police officer, he still was not allowed to patrol without a non-white officer as his partner. Like, there were simply places he could not go as a Los Angeles police officer who was black without a white, you know, chaperone. Mm.
I would also recommend on this topic, L.A. Noir by John Bunton. No relation, but I did know him in college and we called each other cuz. And it's an excellent book. And I would say that even if we weren't Dutch cousins. But yeah, there's, I think that the book is good and worth reading for people who care about this genre of crime and genre of history. If you've never gotten around to it, I recommend it. It is a fairly quick read, which is good, because did we mention the 491 pages? Yes, we did.
It's not a short read. Yeah.
No, it's not a short read, but it moves right along. Even the courtroom parts, which like you quickly, I like a book that sort of lets you know when it's okay to like throttle down and just like flip ahead a few pages, and it does that. Wambaugh is a good writer. I haven't read any of his other stuff, but it's definitely worth it, and I think it's earned its spot. But the fact is, because it was so far ahead of most of what we consider true crime classics, except like one or two books, it doesn't, I'm just not sure it has that sustain. But it is, I mean, I think it is an enduring book and an enduring story. And I really wanted to like the film version more than I did, but I think it might have suffered from my having just read the book like and completed it that morning.
Did it
didn't stack up really for you? Let me just give you some background. This was a 1979 release. It wasn't a TV movie. Ted Danson plays Ian Campbell. He is
in his debut, right?
I believe so. Yes. Yeah. And he's like so tall and foxy, even when he's playing the stupid fucking bagpipes, kind of can't believe it. And I had this weird, like, flash forward to him in Fargo season 2, which I thought was an extremely underrated performance from him. John Savage is Carl Hettinger. James Woods is Greg Powell. The late Franklin Seals is Jimmy Smith. And then you have all sorts of, hey, it's that guy's, John Delancey, aka Q.
Ronnie Cox.
Yep, Ronnie Cox. We'll hear a couple of them in various clips. I think it did a good job adapting the story. And I do think that if I had not just read the book, that I would have been more compelled and less kind of lulled by the spots in which things were obviously telescoped and composited to save time. And in that regard, since this was made in 79, you did have a certain perspective on the outcomes of the cases that Wambaugh did not get to have for the book. And the performances are okay, but like, I don't know. There's something in like Hettinger's flight from the killers that does not translate at all. I thought it was much more suspenseful in the book, even though I did know that he escaped. Did you agree?
I did agree. I think the moment where Ian Campbell is murdered, for as much as it relies on, you know, a good half dozen sort of movie magic cliches to happen, is genuinely horrifying.
Yeah.
Like I feel like that moment seizes your chest right up. And then there was something about the flight. You're right. The flight of Hettinger from the scene, Hettinger from the scene of the murder, which is blocked badly and clumsily. Like in the book, they described that the guy essentially had to dash through a field of onions that were cutting and tearing at him, and he hid in the field of onions. The book makes so much more of the fact that this murder took place in this very unique setting, between two fields of onions.
Yeah, there was low wire that was designed to keep animals and pests away. There was really no light, which is like not really possible to replicate in a film. So yeah.
But it was
blocked a little bit silent movie-ishly. And John Savage is a good actor and very likable and relatable, but he's a little bit too like compared with the book and the absolute suicidal, unrelenting, unrelieved despair that this person feels. I felt like that portrayal was a little bit glib.
Yeah, it doesn't quite let you in. Mm. Like there are actors who are very good at saying nothing and giving you an idea of what's behind the eyes. Like Bill Murray is excellent at that. Jodie Foster is excellent at that. You really got the sense from this movie that everything you needed to know about Carl Hettinger was sort of the thing that he said. And that to me is short selling what is best about the book. I think Wambaugh makes absolutely the correct decision that the beating heart of the onion field, even though it's a book with four principal characters, it sort of doesn't structurally trap itself there, and it makes Carl Hettinger the main character, which means the book is about a lot more than just a sort of sensationalistic murder of a police officer, that it's about trauma and healing. And I think the movie makes an attempt at that, but I think spends far too much time focusing on sort of the procedural details of the outcome of the case rather than that.
Mm. It is cast extremely well. James Woods is a good choice. Wambaugh makes much of this like creepy, long Beetlejuice monster-y neck.
Yeah.
That the real Greg Powell has. James Woods does not have that, and the physical resemblance is not great. Mm-hmm. But he definitely gets at that nervous energy and like annoying too bigness that Jimmy's interior monologue spends a lot of time complaining about. In the clip we're about to hear, another character is actually doing the bitching that Jimmy is doing like in his mind in the book. Mm-hmm. But the delivery is pretty classic, and this is Mr. Lee Weaver, aka Buck Naked on Hill Street Blues, as Billy, and James Woods and Franklin Seals as Greg and Jimmy. Here's clip two.
Jimmy, I use this little hop, skip, jump, which moves me fast. Moreover, it isn't noticeable to someone passing by like running would be. When you see me skip, start this baby moving. Skip, jump. Like a goddamn kangaroo jumping around out there. All this funny talk. Furthermore, wherefore? Don't give me any more furthermore or whereovers, any more of that funky ass bullshit.
Greg said he was paroled out of Vacaville. That's a nut jail.
Bill James also notes that Franklin Seals gives, in his opinion, the best performance in the film version of The Onion Field. Franklin Seals was probably best known from being on Silver Spoons.
Yeah, Dexter on Silver Spoons.
And died in 1990 of complications of AIDS, which I like. The number of times that I'll be watching some older property and be like, whatever happened to that guy?
Yeah,
it's that way too many times. So he really is very good here.
He is. And I actually read up a little bit on Franklin Seals, and Franklin Seals sort of suffered not only from being a closeted gay man in Hollywood, but also being someone who was biracial, and you know, dunderheaded casting agents could never decide if he was a black actor or a Latino actor or how to cast him. I just feel like if Franklin Seals had been born 30 years later, he would have been perfect for this moment we're in. Like, I feel like he would have been, you know, he would have been one of those like great, can count on every single time character actors like a Michael Pena or a someone like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think he was just his talents were squandered by people who were not able to see them.
Yeah, he there's also something in the book where I think Wambaugh is not entirely sure. I think we're never going to know who fired the four shots. The first shot was Powell.
Yeah.
We're never really going to know whether Jimmy fired the four shots, why he mm-hmm. chose not to say anything. But there is this, you know, ambiguity at the heart of him that it's clear that Greg Powell is a, you know, bad actor, as they say, and a sociopath. But Jimmy's institutional man thing is different. And the book is pretty good at just sort of telling you, like giving you quotes from Jimmy Smith and telling you about his, you know, various number two behaviors and then just letting you draw your own conclusions. But that's pretty tough to play.
Yeah,
that's one thing in text, but on screen it's different. And Jimmy has this speech in the book, which is reproduced pretty closely in this scene we're about to hear with Ronnie Cox, about how feeling guilty is a white man's construct.
Oh yeah.
And like I said, this is really a tough line to play because it's like, what? But I mean, but then it makes sort of perfect sense coming from this guy, given everything that he's been through in his life. So here's clip four.
Jimmy, have you ever felt bad when you did something wrong?
Like how?
Has your conscience ever bothered you? Like feeling guilty?
Mr. Brooks, I believe, I think, that is something that rich white guys dreamed up to keep guys like me down. I honest don't believe there is such a thing, such a feeling. Guilty. That's just something the man says in court when your luck runs out.
I mean, yeah. Kind of
yeah.
like where's the lie there? I can't point to one. That's he has a tough job because I don't think anybody, least of all Jimmy knows what drives Jimmy or what is sort of at the, what is the, you know, unpopped kernel of at the center of Jimmy. So like Powell is pretty easy. You just act kind of buggy. And, you know, Woods is good at that. And they also are in the position of having to imply while not really being able to say anything about it, the sexual preferences or whatever, the sexual preference leverage used by either or both of these guys, and they do a decent job with that too, but you know.
Yeah, I think you make a very good point. It is very hard to play a number two because it's sort of against the instincts of an actor,
yeah.
which is to draw attention to oneself. And it's also like, and it also serves well the way Wambaugh characterizes Jimmy in the book, which is someone that things happen to and not someone who says, well, my biggest problem essentially says my biggest problem is I make bad decisions, which I conflate with having bad luck. Mm. And that's like, we could view that as an excuse for bad behavior, but it's also like, yeah, if Jimmy doesn't know how to stop making bad decisions, that's a solution that we as a society don't really have, or don't for some reason don't like to trouble ourselves with.
Yeah, and we also see in the book, and this is like impossible to play, so it's toned down a bit from the movie. But in the book, or you know, in life, you see Jimmy Smith having the occasional spasm of proactive mania. In his own interest, or so he thinks, And then that will be followed by, like, there's a scene, you'll see this in the visual aids, which is Blotter Presents across social media, that the scene in which, like, 7 years of legal wrangling is boiled down to a, like, 4-minute scene. In the background of it, Jimmy is asleep.
Yes.
Gregory Pell is preparing a motion very officiously. Jimmy is asleep, like, like in his chair. And actually, here is a clip from that scene that, well, let's play it, and then I have a couple of questions.
2 years of pretrial motions. It's a war of attrition, and the obstructionists are winning. Our judge almost dies of a heart attack, so we get a new judge. Start all over again. 2 years. Gail, I've been on this case for 6 years. There's no finality in the law. The American system of justice is incomprehensible to the world.
Mr. Halpin.
Could you please lower your voice, sir? I'm trying to prepare a new motion.
Motions to exhume Campbell's body. Motions to quash the jury panel for racism. Demands for softer beds.
Well, there's Bill James's argument, basically. But yeah, that's one of the later prosecutors. Like, you do see a character at some point that I think is supposed to be Kanarek, because that was who was physically confronted by one of the DAs. But he's not mentioned by name. His affiliation with Manson's defense is never mentioned, which, again, that's probably wise, because talk about pulling focus. But the film, it's weird. Like, of course they have to boil the legal stuff down as far as they can, or it'll be a, you know, miniseries longer than Roots. But at the same time, this is part of the story. This is part of it. Even if it's sort of dull and you're like flipping through it in the book, this is part of what made this kind of a landmark story and a memorable case, is how many turns there were, like how long they were on this road, literally and figuratively. So,
yeah, I mean, I think in the hands of I think this movie suffers from being written at a screenplay level by the person who wrote the book. I think there is probably a more artful cinematic way to render what you're talking about, because it does need to be in this story. This case is minus that is really only a case of a police officer slaying and the fact that his partner survived, of which in the history of the LAPD you could probably dig up 10 more just like it that happened before the Onion Field. What this comes along at a very distinct point in the history of criminal justice in this country. I do wonder if this was the best way to convey it. And it seems almost like film stage readings of portions of the book rather than a movie.
Yeah, there were some like direct quotes that were like, well, it wasn't that good the first time, but okay. Like, to be there's the thing, right, partner? Like, okay. Wasn't that clever the first time. Okay, yeah. Well, I don't know. Like, I feel like my admiration for both these properties has not been properly conveyed. And I will say that, like, we each had to buy the movie on DVD because it is not, like, even illegally, it's nowhere to be found.
Yeah.
And I must say, rather surprised, given the esteem in which this movie is held by film critics and true crime people, that nobody has gotten the rights to it yet, but Hulu or someone, hear our cry, because...
Yeah, no kidding.
I mean, that's ridiculous. Also, I think I'm just going to give away my copy of the DVD, so maybe there will be a little drawing. for that.
Yeah, you can have mine too. Like I don't say that because I didn't like the movie. I say that because I think that like the fact that it's just in this perpetual limbo, which is all too common in our streaming era, is something that should not be.
Yeah, I mean, I would have paid money to rent it on Amazon Prime, but that wasn't an option. Like, yeah, that's very odd. All right, so stay tuned. Once again, Blotter Presents on Facebook and Twitter for the opportunity to win yourself a complimentary copy of this on DVD. In the meantime, Kevin, what is your recommendation in terms of listeners who have not consumed either of these making a selection, or if you think they should see and or read both, what order they should do it in?
Yeah, I mean, I almost like I almost feel like The Onion Field, the book, should be part of a like intro to true crime course that we enroll and instruct ourselves in.
Agreed.
And it begins with In Cold Blood and then goes to The Onion Field and then, you know, Fatal Vision, Journalist and the Murderer, Stranger Beside Me. And maybe it ends with, God, I don't know where the first course ends. I feel like there's some socially significant event in the 1980s from a true crime point of view. Maybe it ends with the Bernard Goetz subway shooting or something like that. That's totally speculative, but something that brings to a close the first era of true crime literature and sets us up for the second. I think this book read in that context, sort of after In Cold Blood and before Fatal Vision and Journalist and the Murderer, is the right way to do it. And then see how the book makes you feel in that context. If you're interested in seeing this conveyed visually, and there are certainly moments of Los Angeles in 1963 and the murder of Ian Campbell itself, which cry out to be seen visually, then pick up the movie. Also, if you are just simply interested in a movie that was not a box office hit, I'm guessing no one had in mind that this movie was going to be, you know, the scorcher of the summer or something. And yet had a lot of, if you like those movies that have a lot of actors you recognize in them before they are famous, this is a really good example of that. And I'm a particular fan of those kind of movies.
Yeah. And Bill James is right about one thing at least, and that's Franklin Seals's performance is really something. I would have to say, I think this book is considered canon, at least in the sort of like, let's call it the Bronze Age of true crime, even though some of the books are like undisputed classics that are head and shoulders above others. It was the, you know, it was the beginning. So I think that if you're going to consider yourself completely read in the genre, as I, you know, finally can, I guess.
Not yet for me, but
this is, I think it's an essential book, and I think it's a good book. It's not one that's going to feel there. It's going to feel a little homeworky, but I think it's a necessity if you want to sort of understand the evolution of this genre. The movie is also good, but if you only, you know, if you've only sort of got room in your life for one, The Onion Field will be at the library for sure. Mm-hmm. And actually the movie may be at your library too. I only like deal with books and audiobooks in my app, but it's just a little easier to put hands to the book, and I recommend it.
Yeah, me too.
And Kevin, I'm sorry that you had to buy this DVD. Maybe we should do like a bi-coastal giveaway.
That sounds great. Yeah.
Okay, excellent. We're gonna pay that forward. Well, thank you for this discussion, and I'm glad that I knocked this off my list at last. That was really becoming an embarrassing blind spot for me.
You're welcome, Sarah. Happy
So where else can listeners find you and your work?
You can find me at kevinsmokler.com. That's S-M-O-K-L-E-R. And on the socials, I'm mostly on Twitter at Weegee, W-E-E-G-E-E.
Great. Thank you so much. And folks, keep an eye on Twitter for free loot. In the meantime, there's no new main podcast next week, but there will be briefs on Shadow of Truth, Ministry of Evil, and more. And then Piper Weiss goes for the Blotter Presents hat trick with Leaving Neverland. There's also an interview with Abducted in Plain Sight's director Skye Borgman coming up, and Stephanie Green returns for yet more Theranos and the child killings in Oakland County. Until then, if you've got a tip for the Blotter Presents, you can find me on social. That's Blotter Presents on Facebook and Twitter. You can email me at bunting@the-blotter.com. And you can become an official Blotter tipster at the Blotter's Patreon page. That's patreon.com/blotterpresents. If you like the podcast, I'd love it if you'd leave a review on iTunes. If you don't like the podcast, I'd love it if you keep that to yourself. My guest has been Kevin Smokler. He's on Twitter @Ouija. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.